Hello and welcome to Season 4, Episode 1 of Catching Up on Capitol Hill, a series in which we discuss the latest in tax legislation and in tax policy. I'm your host, John Gimigliano. It's good to be back with you, and oh boy, do we have a lot to talk about this year. Unlike Season 3, where we spoke in circles seemingly about tax extenders till there was really nothing left to say, my list of topics for this season is limited really by our time and availability to record that many episodes. I suspect you know why. Obviously, we have an important election coming in November, but that's not what is really driving the inevitability of major tax legislation in the near future. Instead, it's the looming tax cliff, the $4 trillion of scheduled tax increases coming at the end of 2025. And that gives tax legislation its coming date with destiny, no matter who wins in November. So today, in episode one for this season, let's look back before we look forward, since, you know, what's past is prologue and all that. And to do that, we're joined by my friend and colleague and familiar voice to all of you, Jen Acuna. You know, Jen, when I think about the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act and the years-long effort that preceded it, I really think of you as patient zero of tax reform. Trust me, it's a compliment, but what do I mean by that? Well, you helped develop the first prototype of tax reform at the Ways and Means Committee, the thing that became known as the Camp Draft. Now, that bill didn't really go anywhere, but it did outline many of the possibilities for reform that became adapted for the TCJA. And then you helped develop the House blueprint for tax reform that really caused the whole reform process to gain momentum. And then most importantly, you moved over to the Senate and you were a lead drafter of the Senate version of the TCJA, the version that ultimately became law. So yeah, you were there at the beginning and at the end. So Jen, let's take a stroll down memory lane as we ask the all important question for the next many months. How did we find ourselves here, just 7 years later, standing at the precipice of the tax cliff? So Jen, welcome. I'm going to ask you, before we talk about like how did the TCJA play out and how did we get to all these expiring items, I want to ask you a different question. And here's the first question. It's a big one, but I know one you've spent a lot of time thinking about back in 2017 anyway. What were the main goals of the TCJA when you worked on it all those years and members of Congress worked on it all those years? What were the main goals you were trying to solve for?
That is such a good question, because as tax people, we get lost within the provisions of a bill, not just the TCJA, but most bills. But when you take a step back from the TCJA, I think there were a lot of political objectives, but also significant policy objectives that for a long time had been bipartisan objectives that were achieved in the TCJA. The first one, the one that folks are most familiar with, is the reduction of the corporate rate. The corporate rate was 35%. And I remember in the years leading up to, and you mentioned that I'm patient zero, I think of the monkey from Outbreak, that movie, where I hope I'm not
I
the
said
monkey
it was
from
a
Outbreak.
Compliment, Jen. Yeah.
I am taking it as a compliment. The monkey was very charismatic animal in the movie, but the corporate rate was really high, 35%. We were leading, and that is not a compliment with respect to our corporate rate among our trading partners. So that was not a good thing. And what members really cared about and what drove them to want to reduce the corporate rate was that on a weekly basis, it seemed, for many years, dating back to 2015, even earlier, we were getting announcements of traditional U.S. companies inverting, moving their headquarters offshore, citing the U.S. corporate rate as not necessarily the primary factor, but certainly a complicating factor in remaining in the U.S. So members were up in arms about this. When I was on the House Ways and Means Committee staff, I was charged, having the international portfolio, with putting together a spreadsheet. Every time a U.S. company announced that it was going to be moving its headquarters offshore, inverting, restructuring, I had to put it in the spreadsheet. How many employees were in that headquarters were employed in the U.S.? How long has it been located in the United States? And so on. And I remember this spreadsheet was not insignificant. It wasn't a handful of companies. We had a spreadsheet with dozens of companies that had just over the last 3 years that I tracked it had announced relocating. And that was a big concern for Congress. It was certainly a big concern among the members that ultimately voted for the TCJA. So the corporate rate, it was kind of one way to go about it because we'd bring these CEOs in, they would talk to members of Congress. We had hearings about it. The one issue that they all agreed on, regardless of industry, is that the corporate rate was too high. In the United States, it was simply not competitive. The next one was international reform. This was a big issue, the corporate inversion issue and shifting of U.S. headquartered companies overseas to more competitive waters. The members really did want to reform the international tax system. That was another recurring theme. When we talk to CEOs, CFOs of big U.S. multinational enterprises, is that our international system was just extremely outdated. Our worldwide system of taxation was outdated. There was a lot of frustration with respect to the lockout effect, foreign earnings, and members certainly wanted to do something about that and shift to something that was a little more like our trading partners and move to a territorial system with backstops. Next was the individual title. You can't just focus, especially from a political perspective, certainly does not make sense to move a bill that addresses a lack of competitiveness on the corporate side without also addressing the individual taxpayer. After all, individuals are voters. And there was a significant effort among members, and there was a rising level of frustration that was kind of compounded by a lot of the frustrations that constituents would express to members on a regular basis about the complexity of the U.S. tax code as it relates to individuals. We often talk about the corporate system is extremely complex. Yes, but there were a lot of individual taxpayers that were not able to just use a standard deduction. They had to be itemizers. And that just led to a lot of frustration. A lot of members would hear about this. A majority of members would hear the complaints from the constituents and wanted to do something about it. So the TCJA also addressed that by doubling the standard deduction, simplifying the individual code in order to raise the percentage of U.S. taxpayers that would not have to itemize on their return.
So I remember at the time, both these came from Kevin Brady, who at the time the TCJA, he was the Republican Ways and Means chair, so the lead drafter in the House. Two separate things that he said, because one, on the inversions topic, you're right, we were seeing an erosion of the U.S. tax base. And it was a question like, how do we prevent that? And there were lots of proposals to deal with inversions, which were basically to make them impossible to do. And I remember Kevin Brady saying something like, we don't want to build walls, we want to build bridges. Now, look, it's a little corny, right? But you get his point, which is, look, you can force people, like you say, you absolutely cannot leave. We're building the wall so high you can never get out. But I think his philosophy was like, we'd rather build a bridge, like encourage people to come here. And so I remember that. And so I'm going to ask you if that was a goal, whether it was achieved. And then the separate one, again, with Kevin Brady, was the oft said refrain that we are going to allow people to do their tax returns on a postcard, right? Mm-hmm. And that was largely at the effort of simplification. That didn't happen. But I guess the question in both those cases, if those were motivating factors, do you look back at the TCJA and say, were we or were we not successful?
Oh my goodness, John, the postcard. I recall every member, whether they were for the TCJA or against the TCJA, talking about this postcard. Members would carry around a copy of the postcard because members love to have props. And they had like a postcard, something that looked like a postcard that resembled a tax return. From a corporate inversion perspective, the proof is really in the pudding. We've seen the results, and hindsight is 2020. But we have seen a significant slowdown of big U.S. companies announcing a relocation or a restructuring in a manner that relocates their headquarters offshore. So I think in that sense, there have been a number of papers that have been published that have noted that there has been a significant drop. And that is certainly attributable, at least in part, to the reduction in the corporate rate. So from that perspective, members could say pretty confidently that they're no longer having to troubleshoot that weekly press assignment of having to explain to their constituents why their local large multinational is relocating its headquarters overseas. So I think in that respect, it certainly has been a success. On the individual side, we're going to see whether or not, I mean, we have seen a surge in individual taxpayers, and that's all available in the statistics of income that are published by the Internal Revenue Service. But the sheer number, the volume of individuals that have to itemize has gone down. Mm-hmm. So by that token, just looking at the numbers alone, certainly a success. Is it more simple? Itemizing is a bit of a pain. But those that can file using the simple standard deduction, it is a much easier way to file, certainly.
Right. We may not have gotten to the postcard, but I don't think there's any debating that for many Americans, tax returns are simpler now today if you don't have to itemize. The AMT is less of an issue. So didn't get all the way there, but got part of the way there. That's kind of our background. What were we trying to do? Did we think we achieved it? In some cases, yes. Some cases, a little mixed review, but no legislation is perfect. So here's the question. We've been teeing up this problem of the tax cliff of 2025. Obviously, we've got $4 trillion of expiring tax cuts from the TCJA. The obvious question for people to ask, I get it all the time, which is, why did Republicans do that to themselves? They finally had a chance to do tax reform. Why did they set up so many provisions to expire so that now here we are, 7 years later, facing down this possibility of this tax cliff?
We get that question on a regular basis. What is going on with all of these expiring tax provisions? Our foreign trading partners do not have this regular exercise with tax extenders and expiring tax provisions. And what's interesting is that it's partly and primarily due to the vehicle with which it was passed, which was reconciliation. That's a procedural vehicle. It allows the Senate to pass a piece of legislation that has an impact on the budget. In this case, it was a tax bill. Usually they are a tax bill, but to move it with a simple majority where you only need 51 votes in order to pass it versus 60. So you don't need a filibuster-proof majority. Because of that, the rules of reconciliation dictate that even if you have a bill that increases the deficit, Congress is driven by the 10-year budgetary window. So if you look at that 10-year budget in a reconciliation bill, the reconciliation bill cannot increase the federal budget by a penny outside of the 10-year window. So all of the spending has to be done within the 10 years. That's why you see, especially if you just look at the TCJA, for example, the most expensive provisions that were not offset, that weren't paired with a way to raise money so that they net out in the out years, they expire, they sunset. And they usually sunset around year 8 because they need that 2-year window for the cost of the provision to kind of peter out through the system so that it doesn't increase the deficit outside of year 10.
Beyond the expiration date, there's always a little leakage. So you have to have them expire. Because that's another question like, well, wait, TCJA was 2017. Why isn't the tax cliff 2027 instead of 2025? You just explained why.
It's year 8. That's the magic year.
It's a procedural question. It wasn't a choice that Republicans made. Like, oh, this is a great idea. Let's go through all this trouble to pass a bill only to have it expire. You really didn't have a choice. These provisions that were so expensive, you did not have offsets to offset them down to revenue neutral over the long haul. That's right?
That is right. If it had been a revenue neutral bill, well, then you don't have to worry about year 11 because you're not increasing the deficit. It's revenue neutral. You don't have to worry about it. But then what you do have to worry about is, are you actually delivering a tax cut? And on the individual side, the TCJA, a lot of the sunsets are on the individual side. Those were net tax cuts. Mm-hmm. So they were paired with offsets, but they expire because there was no significant offset that would pay for them outside of the 10-year window.
Yeah, it's a good reminder. This is always the problem with budget reconciliation bills, right? It's a great deal. Oh, we can pass a bill with 51 votes, not 60. Why wouldn't we always do that? Well, this is why you don't always do it. There's a lot of reasons why you don't always. You can't always get a reconciliation bill. But when you have one, it's still an imperfect tool for making tax policy because you so often end up with temporary law, which we all would agree is not ideal from a policy perspective, right? It takes away that certainty from taxpayers who like to manage their affairs, arrange their affairs, knowing what the law is going to be. And this is the same problem that we may find ourselves when we get to the tax cliff of 2025.
It creates cliffs.
It creates cliffs. Like if you'd had 60 votes, you would have made it all permanent, right? But you didn't have 60 votes. Right. Okay. All right. So look, we talked about these expiring items. Remind us. I think it's well documented. We put out a document. It's everywhere. But remind us again, what are the major expiring 2025 items?
The major expiring 2025 items, the entire individual tax title. That is not one item. It's a big cluster of items, but it's a multi-trillion dollar cluster. Every individual rate reverts back to pre-TCJA, so pre-2017. So every rate goes up Also, the brackets go back, and not a lot of people talk about the brackets reverting back to pre-TCJA, but those were significantly modified in the TCJA. That was part of that, trying to shift the brackets to include more income in the lower brackets, shifting them away from the higher brackets. So there's certainly going to be some pain on the bracket front. Also, modifications to the individual AMT. So the exemption amount was increased. So fewer taxpayers, that's part of that simplification, fewer taxpayers that were AMT taxpayers pre-TCJA, they're all going to revert back into the individual AMT. So a lot of those had some relief during the interim between 2017 and taxable years beginning before 2025. The increase in the standard deduction, that was doubled. So that also reverts back. The increased child tax credit reverts back. A little bit of good news, the SALT cap, that $10,000 cap that was introduced and passed in the TCJA on state and local tax, that also expires. That was one of the pay-fors, but that also expires with the rest of the individual title. The increase in the state tax exemption, there was an increase that reverts back to pre-TCJA levels. A biggie that is part of the individual tax title because it affects pass-through business, and certainly is a big ticket item, is 199 Cap A, the pass-through deduction, that expires. It isn't modified after 2025. It just goes away with the rest of the individual tax title. And that's a big one that certainly from a political perspective is one that members are very concerned about expiring. The rest of the provisions, the other big ticket items, at least on the corporate side, are more modifications because, as we know, the corporate rate in the TCJA was permanent. But that was also paired with a lot of corporate raisers. So a lot of the revenue that was lost with that corporate rate reduction, by definition, had to be made up within the corporate tax title and the international tax title. So GILTI doesn't expire. That was part of the corporate raiser. In fact, the rate goes up on the GILTI. The FDII benefit goes down. BEAT has a significant number of changes as well with respect to general business credits, and its rate goes up. So there are a number of offsets that become harsher at the end of 2025 for taxable years beginning after 2025 on the corporate front, and on the individual front, it's just a total sunset.
Right. It's a lot, right? That's how you get to $4 trillion. You got the CFC look-through rule expires, so that goes away, and the estate tax exemption amount gets cut more or less in half. See how you get to $4 trillion, and of that $4 trillion, the vast majority of that cost is on the individual side. Fair to say?
Oh, absolutely. Just on the individual income tax side, it's right. $2.5 trillion, and that's on net. So that includes some of the items that paid for the individual cuts, like SALT.
Yeah. I mean, I have so many thoughts on SALT. I know you do, too, because we talk about this all the time and the rest of the team. I hope we can do an episode on SALT. It's not something that a lot of our clients are thinking about every day, but there's so many interesting policy and political angles on SALT. You got the state tax workarounds, which have all emerged since 2017. It's just fascinating issues around SALT. But yeah, that one expires. Hooray! But don't forget, you lose your AMT exemption amount too. Boo! And so, are you really in a better position? Don't get too excited just yet on how that all might play out. That's a good point. All right, let me ask you another question. So you said what these expiring items are, but you said some are permanent. How did you decide which ones should be permanent and which ones should be temporary, like the corporate rate, permanent, individual rates, temporary? How was that decision made?
It's a strategic decision, and it's a policy provision. A lot of things do factor into that decision-making. One of the issues is from a policy perspective, when you look at the spreadsheet of every provision, how is it going to impact the economic model? That's the one thing that members ask. Okay, well, if we have the sunset, how is that going to impact the economy? And the one thing that we heard again and again and again was that a temporary corporate rate reduction, you would not see in the macroeconomic model a potential increase in economic activity. And you wouldn't achieve that competitiveness because, corporations don't plan on a year-to-year basis. They have long horizons. So that needs to be considered in the permanent bucket. Political fates change. One party could have single party control after one Congress and lose political power in the following Congress. Things change, and we've seen that. So the question is, okay, well, how do we strategize in a way to preserve the cuts? And usually the strategy, and I think it was here, is that you look at provisions that would be popular on a bipartisan basis. So regardless of who's in power, there's going to be enough political support to extend. And that is where you get the individual rates expiring. Another issue is, are there enough offsets, ways to raise money outside of the 10-year window that would not be politically disastrous? If you had these individual rate cuts, if you had put them in as permanent, they would have to be paired in year 8 with a significant individual tax increase or another big tax increase. Would that be politically palatable? So from a political and from a policy perspective, you know, the individual title was the one that was best positioned to potentially sunset because it would create this political pressure to extend.
I get it. Of course, that opened the TCJA up to criticism. There was obviously criticism against the TCJA in many fronts, but one of them was, well, there you go. Republicans chose corporations over people, right? Because they made the corporate permanent, but they didn't the individual rates permanent. So it's clear where their priorities lay. There are reasons why it was done. And I'm sure you anticipated that criticism, but now this all comes home to roost next year. This is why we're having this conversation. How is that going to play out?
Definitely. And it also kind of highlights the fact that that corporate rate cut was paid for within the contours of the bill. If it weren't, it would not have met the standard for reconciliation. So that reduction in tax income from the reduction of the corporate rate, that's all made up for with other corporate offsets, new offsets that are, you know, near and dear to our hearts today, but were brand new back in 2017, like the GILTI, like the BEAT. There were a number of offsets that helped pay for that corporate rate reduction.
Yeah. Of course, the counterpoint to that is, look, money's fungible. Could you have used the offsets elsewhere? But you outlined the reasons why it was done the way it was done. That is what it is. So there's no undoing that now. The question is simply, how do we deal with the expiring individual cuts when we get the next year? So that leads me to my last question for you. And it's a hard one, but give it some thought, because that is a really interesting question. I think it's a question we're going to come back to all year, which is, in the years since the TCJA, a lot's happened, right? We had the attempt to roll back much of the TCJA, partly through Build Back Better, did not pass, but we saw that. We've seen the emergence of BEPS 2.0, Pillar 1, Pillar 2 in particular, in some ways as a response to the TCJA. We've seen politics change. The House, shortly after the TCJA, went from Republican control to Democratic control, then has gone from Democratic control back to Republican control, depending on the election, could theoretically go back to Democratic control. What have we learned in the years since the TCJA that might help us think about how this is going to go when we get to 2025? Anything?
I don't think that we have learned a whole lot. Back then, it was more controversial to have these expiring tax provisions. But now you see, whenever there is single party control, you see reconciliation bills. And reconciliation bills necessarily lead to temporary tax policy. If anything, it has certainly increased congressional appetite for expiring tax provisions, and it doesn't seem to be slowing down. We had the Inflation Reduction Act. We had ARPA during last Congress. Congress has not seemed to be shying away from temporary tax policy.
Right. The irony is that, like, if you take the reconciliation bill, the big pay for there was the corporate alternative minimum tax, CAMTI, to offset the cost of the renewable energy credits, et cetera. Well, those renewable energy credits are temporary. CAMTI is permanent, right? So the revenue raisers tend to be permanent. SALT maybe being one of the outliers here, but they tend to be permanent, whereas the tax cuts tend to be temporary. And I guess if there's something that we can take from that, that we should learn about next year, is if one party controls everything, right? Republicans control everything or Democrats control everything. We're probably looking at another reconciliation bill, which probably means that whatever solution we come up with 2025 is going to be at least in part temporary. Is that fair to say?
That is fair to say. And we're probably looking at two reconciliation bills, because Congress gets one reconciliation bill per fiscal year, and the next Congress would run two fiscal years. So a lot of opportunity for temporary tax policy.
Oh, help us all. Because I agree with your point that, you know, everybody would agree that businesses rely on stability, predictability on the laws in terms of how they make investments. And so any of this is that is, again, temporary. It's certainly, I would imagine, better than having tax cuts expire totally, but not that much better, right? Having them permanent would be far better in terms of attracting investment, encouraging investment.
Yep, you need a bipartisan bill to do that.
Yeah, or at least enough revenue raisers, as you showed in the TCJA, that are long-lasting to make parts of it permanent, like the corporate rate. But that's really, really hard to do, and it was hard for you all to do, and you only were able to do some of it, not all of it.
It's a very difficult exercise. The exercise back in 2012 and 2015 on the House side, the CAMP bill, and I think there was also an exercise on the Senate side to produce a revenue-neutral bill. They're really hard because members really hard. Like one side of the equation, which is the spending piece, not too keen on the other side of the equation, which is the raisers piece.
Right. So that raises a separate question, one we're going to get to this season. Future episodes include, would the all-Democratic scenario look like? What would the all-Republican scenario look like? And then maybe the hardest of all to predict is, what does a divided control look like? Because to pass a bill in the divided control, we're not doing budget reconciliation, okay? We can talk about why in that episode, but we're not. And so that's going to require a 60-vote bill, to which you'd be like, hooray, permanent tax policy. But the problem is, what can 60 senators agree to, knowing that's going to be almost certainly a combination of Republicans and Democrats? And then you go, well, can they only agree to a temporary extension? So you end up with temporary tax policy anyway. Let's just leave that as a hanging question for now, Jen, one that we will come back to. Awesome conversation today. It's good to be back with you. In closing today, let me keep this short, but I think it's important that I address this issue at the outset of the discussion of 2025. It's unavoidable that we are going to spend a lot of time talking about the expiring TCJA provisions and therefore about the TCJA itself. The topic is a polarizing one in tax circles, and it has been from the beginning, and really it hasn't changed much in the last 7 years. So let's be clear. We're not here to opine on whether the TCJA was good or whether it was bad. We are only here to simply say what is. We're the Switzerland of the tax policy world, if you will. And you know this, there is no shortage of politicians or of think tanks on the right and on the left to tell you how wonderful or terrible the TCJA was. If that's what you want, it's a Google search away. But I'll leave you with this one thought, and maybe this is as far as we'll go on this point. If you have in your mind that the TCJA was good, or if you have in your mind that you think it was bad, well, maybe try a little bit harder, because I think it was objectively both. Jen, I'm sure you'll agree that the TCJA is imperfect, but all legislation is. There are political, procedural, practical compromises that must be made along the way to enactment. Remember this, the worst tax policy ideas are the ones that will never be enacted. So let's leave it to other people to discuss those ideas because, you know, we're busy people here, and I suspect most of you are too. But is this duality of the TCJA, both good and regrettable characteristics at the same time, that will make 2025 so interesting? As Congress grapples with which aspects to extend, which ones to double down on, and which ones to move on from. So as we stand here at the edge of the tax cliff, take a second to look around. There's a lot to see. And we're looking forward to exploring it with you over the next year. With that, thanks again for tuning in to Catching Up on Capitol Hill. We'll be back with you soon. Until then, take care.